Images from these Hindi films often flash through my mind as I waited for Richard to satisfy himself with yet another trick and to return to me. Scenes from movies, the titles of which are long forgotten. And those songs. Yes, those filmy songs with the poignant lyrics that epitomize the suffering of love and that only Lata can sing.
My first lover went mad. The second went
straight.
The third guy turned into a Christian fundamentalist. I obviously have a devastating effect on men.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Same-gender partners progress in Alberta and New South Wales, an East Indian man's ode to growing up in Kenya and coming out in West Hollywood, and a gay San Francisco teen's hilarious exploration of 1960s sex and mayhem. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending June 1st, 2002. In Canada, the Conservative province of Alberta is extending pension benefits to the domestic partners of its unmarried civil servants, including same-gender partners, the provincial justice minister announced this week. Some top provincial managers won the benefit earlier this year as the result of a lawsuit. Now another lawsuit has forced its extension to beneficiaries of five other pension plans, including provincial and municipal employees, nurses, police officers, judges, and teachers. In mid-May, Alberta's government unveiled its draft bill to amend an array of provincial laws to recognize domestic partners.
The Australian state of New South Wales is also moving towards equality for gay and lesbian and other unmarried couples. Last week, State Attorney General Bob Debus announced his government's plan to reform 23 state laws regarding court proceedings, work entitlements, including survivor benefits, and other financial issues. That bill may not be discussed in the NSW Parliament until September or October. Gay and lesbian activists are disappointed that the package omits adoption rights and equalization of the age of consent for homosexual acts with that for heterosexual ones. But this week, Debus announced that NSW has earmarked $75,000 per year to support programs to prevent violence against gays, lesbians, and transgenders. One-third of the funds will go to the Schools Out Project against homophobic bullying on campuses.
A mistrial has interrupted for a second time prosecution of criminal charges in connection with the mismanagement of Australia's now-defunct Satellite Group, the first gay-identified corporation ever to go public on a stock exchange. That famous 1999 pink float ended in a financial debacle after less than a year amidst an investigation by ASIC, the Australian Securities and Investment Commission, and numerous criminal and civil allegations against founder Greg Fisher and board member Jonathan Bross. Originally a property company, Satellite acquired the bulk of Australia's gay and lesbian publications and shut them down as it failed. The Satellite entity officially wound up in November, but the legal battles continue. A first criminal prosecution for Fisher and Broster in October was declared a mistrial when two jurors fell ill. Last week, after 2 weeks of trial proceedings, and just before the Sydney District Court judge was to instruct the jury, Crown prosecutors finally obtained from ASIC a Satellite file, which Broster had sought to support his testimony. A mistrial was declared despite Fisher's protest, and prosecutors will have to try again in August.
Britain's Home Secretary David Blunkett this week announced that his government will be funding LAGPA, the Lesbian and Gay Police Association. In a statement, he said the group is contributing to his aims for the police service and that the funds will enable LAGPA to operate on an equal footing with other minority staff associations, such as the National Black Police Association and the British Association of Women Police. LAGPA will use the funds to hire a full-time staff member and become a truly national operation that can support officers in rural as well as metropolitan areas. One of the group's goals is to win pension benefits for officers' same-gender partners.
In the U.S., the California State Senate overwhelmingly approved a constitutional amendment to protect survivors of unmarried couples from postmortem property tax reassessments. The exemption, which currently applies only to legally married couples, would be extended to any couple which had cohabited for at least 5 years before one partner's death or terminal illness. If the State Assembly also approves State Senator Jackie Speier's SCA 9, it will go to a statewide referendum.
Shareholders of oil giant ExxonMobil this week voted down the addition of sexual orientation to the corporate equal employment opportunity statement, but even the Wall Street Journal was impressed by how much support the proposal won, despite management opposition. This was the fourth year that activists led by Trillium Asset Management placed the proposal before shareholders, and this time support almost doubled to nearly one-fourth of the vote. That's due in part to a favorable recommendation from the powerful advisor, Institutional Shareholder Services. Most of ExxonMobil's major competitors specifically protect gays and lesbians from discrimination, but while several other corporations have bowed to shareholder pressure to change their policies, ExxonMobil insists that its existing policy is adequate and had to be forced by the Securities and Exchange Commission to even include the proposal in its proxy materials.
A U.S. law making federal funding for public libraries contingent on their use of internet filtering software was struck down this week by a panel of federal judges. The Children's Internet Protection Act is the third legislative attempt to censor online access in the name of protecting children from pornography, and the third to be blocked by the courts. Gay and lesbian services have been among the plaintiffs in American Civil Liberties Union challenges to all three. The latest ruling found the law violates First Amendment free speech rights because existing software filters block far more than pornography. The Justice Department is expected to appeal the ruling to the U.S. Supreme Court.
As the U.S. observed Memorial Day this week, gay and lesbian military veterans were officially invited participants in the annual wreath-laying ceremony at Arlington National Cemetery for the first time. The Secretary of the Army included the gay and lesbian group American Veterans for Equal Rights, AMVER, among 30 veterans organizations invited to the ceremony organized by the Veterans of Foreign Wars. AMVER, formerly known as the Gay, Lesbian, and Bisexual Veterans of America, was astonished that it was the Bush administration that was the first to recognize them, although the president himself was visiting Normandy rather than present to lay the first wreath. Previously, it took a lawsuit for the Gay and Lesbian Activists Alliance to win the right to lay a wreath at Arlington on Memorial Day beginning in 1980, among a number of other gay and lesbian veterans' struggles with the VFW and the Department of Defense. The Alliance left its wreath at the Tomb of the Unknowns to honor all service members, regardless of their sexual orientation, who gave their lives.
The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees this week named bisexual Italian fashion designer Giorgio Armani a goodwill ambassador. Armani launched a campaign to organize support for refugees from Afghanistan. He said in a statement, "I have always believed that each individual has an opportunity to make a difference, and I hope that I may have a chance to do just that."
Openly gay entertainment mogul David Geffen in early May made the largest single gift to a medical school in U.S. history, $200 million to swell the University of California at Los Angeles endowment by about one-third. In honor of this whopping donation, it will henceforth be known as UCLA's David Geffen School of Medicine.
Open lesbian Dr. Karen Phelps this week was elected to a third year as president of the Australian Medical Association by a nearly 4-1 margin. She's only the second physician ever to win three terms, the maximum AMA rules allow.
Seven U.S. gays and lesbians this week became the first such group to climb to the 20,305-foot summit of Nepal's Imjitse, or Island Peak. The biggest obstacle for the expedition, organized by the nonprofit association Gay Outdoors, was a 500-foot headwall of ice and snow as steep as 60 degrees.
Openly gay Canadian Jay Cochran, self-styled Prince of the Air, last week tightroped nearly 100 meters across Niagara Falls, walking about 40 stories high on a cable less than an inch wide. He'll be repeating the feat several times this year to raise funds for children's charities. Although spectators gasped after a lifetime of tightroping, 58-year-old Cochran called it just another day at the office.
Open lesbian Martina Navratilova has added yet another to her amazing list of all-time tennis records, becoming at age 45 the oldest woman ever to win a Women's Tennis Association Tour title. Navratilova returned to the tour in 2000 after 6 years retirement to play a few doubles tournaments. This week, partnered with Belarusian Natasha Zvereva, she took the doubles crown at the Spanish Open.
And finally, as told by the none-too-gay-friendly newspaper The Scotsman, service in Afghanistan posed an unexpected challenge to British Marines. While their 7-day Operation Condor failed to locate any members of Al-Qaeda, they found by the dozens something at least one Marine found more terrifying: gay male villagers. Those local men not only openly displayed their affection for each other, they propositioned the visiting troops. One corporal, Paul Richard, was quoted as saying, "It was hell. Every village we went into, we got a group of men wearing makeup coming up, stroking our hair and cheeks and making kissing noises." And Marine James Fletcher added, "One bloke who had painted toenails was offering to paint ours."
That's News Wrap for the week ending June 1st, 2002. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
Two very different gay journeys are chronicled in what we might call movies of the mind this week. Coming up later, growing up gay, and a bit bent as well, in 1960s San Francisco. But first, Ghalib Shiraz Dalla is an emerging author whose semi-autobiographical debut novel spans three continents. Called Ode to Lotha and published by Really Great Books, it's the story of an East Indian man whose repressed sexuality growing up in Kenya eventually finds expression in gay West Hollywood. Along the way, he takes comfort in fantasies inspired by legendary Bollywood movies, which are a staple of Hindi Indian culture. Dalla's work has appeared in several magazines, and an excerpt from Ode to Lotha was featured in an American Book Award-winning anthology. He reads from Ode to Lotha during a revealing conversation with This Way Out's Brian Goble.
First of all, please explain the title of the book, Ode to Lotha.
Ode to Lotha is about an East Indian man who has grown up on a steady diet of Bollywood films. And if you're familiar with Bollywood films, an essential ingredient of a Bollywood film is the 8 to 10 songs that each production has. And these songs are almost never sung by the actors or actresses that are acting them out on stage, and recorded actually by playback singers, of whom Lata Mangeshkar is a legend. Since Ali has grown up listening to Lata Mangeshkar's music, he hears her in his mind, in his soul, almost as if providing a soundtrack to his life and his journey.
I'd like to ask you, if you would, to please read an excerpt from the book that describes the protagonist Ali's love of Bollywood films. And if you could, please set the scene for us.
Okay. Well, the part I'm about to read is a part in which Ali is reflecting on his role, not only as a gay man, but as an East Indian, somebody that's grown up to Bollywood films. He has just been jilted by the man that he's obsessed with or thinks he's in love with. And so he is starting to take his direction from Bollywood here.
Images from these Hindi films often flash through my mind as I waited for Richard to satisfy himself with yet another trick and to return to me. Spent, but just a little more tender, I became Jaya Bachchan in Silsila, lamenting in song until tall and handsome Amitabh comes back to her from carousing with his mistress. Faces of actresses whose names I knew so well, scenes from movies, the titles of which are long forgotten, and those songs. Yes, those filmy songs with the poignant lyrics that epitomize the suffering of love and that only Lata can sing. They are all there in their pomp and melodrama, directing me, reminding me, unfurling within me their systematic chaos. How can I help but heed their instinctual direction? It's a hopeless situation. Just like scores of Indian women who have learned to identify with the martyred heroines of Hindi film, I've also learned to relate to them instead of to the independent, free-spirited hero. It's not my role to realize the error of my ways and return to the one I love. Mine is to love unconditionally, shed the perfunctory tears, and wait for dawn. It was in waiting patiently as he caroused in having the opportunity to be there upon his return, to forgive him and take him back, that I had to find my meaning and validation. I don't burst out into song and dance, but I've come to believe in this melodrama, that good has to win. Patience is a virtue that always pays back, and that those who love the most and are willing to suffer for it always get the object of their affection to realize that they belong together. Penance is a prerequisite to romantic fulfillment. Life without the one you love quantified death. Men could leave, but if you had the misfortune of being a woman or relating to one, the respectable thing to do, the right thing to do, was staying. How else was love for an Indian homosexual who grew up in a gilded world of cinema, one who related to the psyche of his dramatic Indian mother, meant to be?
It does seem that Ali feels so much shame about himself, the fact that he is South Asian, and you go on to describe being born in the shadows of colonialism in Kenya. Explain what that was like for Ali growing up in Kenya, and then how it came back to haunt him.
I think for Ali and myself, growing up in Kenya meant accepting certain beliefs, certain social values, which didn't have to be questioned until Ali was plucked out of Kenya and put into Los Angeles. And it is difficult when you have to accept a new way of living, a new way of understanding, as it is for Ali, but it's necessary for his growth. In Kenya, there is a lot of segregation. The black people or the Africans are mostly the lowest rung on the ladder. And I don't mean to say that in any condescending way. It's just a fact because they are the multitude there. Then there are the Asians who are the merchant class. And then we have the Caucasians or the expatriates who even now continue to be on the top rung of the ladder. Once Ali is in Los Angeles, he is suddenly forced to question these values. And his first best friend, a character by the name of Dar in the book, forces him to confront those issues and come to terms with his racist sentiments, because he is somewhat racist, although he doesn't see it that way. And it's a necessary part of his growth to have to confront those things.
In the book, you talk about Ali's relationship with his mother. And his mother actually comes from Kenya to Los Angeles to visit him. And while she is there, Ali is forced to confront his issue of being gay with her.
Ali's mother is just like any other mother. She worries about him, about his search for true love in a city and a lifestyle that is legendary for loneliness and the emotional unavailability of its denizens. And I think ultimately the story of Ali and his mother is an example of unconditional love. I could not give her any of this. I knew that nothing I could do or say at that moment could prepare her for when she returned to Kenya, loaded with the knowledge of what she had only suspected, but now had been confirmed, that her son, her only child, was a homosexual. The world would always be there in places where I could not be, in community functions, dinner parties, family weddings. She would have to face them alone, armed only with the hope that perhaps her son had found a way to educe some happiness from a lifestyle punctuated by loneliness. She would have to accept the reality of the situation, that she was powerless against what she saw as this demon that had possessed her only child, the apple of her eye, wormed, rotting from some vile infection. Everything she had lived and worked for in the past 48 years was standing before her, flawed. I would not hold her. I would not console her. I had to be firm. She had to realize that her manipulations could not rescind anything. My coming out to her would not distance us, but, much to my own revelation, just might bridge us. I am doing this, Mother, so that we can return to that place where we can talk again, where, having cast hybrid expectations aside, we can go back to being real with each other.
Ghalib Dalla, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Ghalib Dalla is the author of Ode to Lata, and it's published by Really Great Books. For This Way Out, I'm Brian Goebel in San Francisco.
This is Dorothy Allison, author of Bastard Out of Carolina and numerous trashy pieces. You're listening to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine.
The showpiece of the homosexual movement in the United States.
A young gay man grows up in San Francisco in the 1950s and early 60s before the love that dare not speak its name found a voice. Fasten your seatbelts for excerpts from a new CD, what its writer-producer Donald Curry calls a movie made of sound, and get swept away on a funky tsunami of sex and mayhem.
My first lover went
mad.
The second went
straight.
The third guy turned into a Christian fundamentalist. The fourth took to drink, and the fifth became a woman. I obviously have a devastating effect on men. This is my story, most of it true. It's a tawdry tale, but whose isn't? We all start our adult lives with the voracious self-importance of an Ayn Rand wannabe. By middle age, it's morphing into Mamet, and one morning you wake up and look in the mirror and think, oh, it's Samuel Beckett. Dude, it's tragic. But at least the literary quality improves. And as a dear friend, now unfortunately deceased, once said to me, girlfriend, think of all the millions of people who've lived anonymous lives and died without a trace. Just like us. So here's my trace. A tale of love, sacred and profane, unrequited and consummated, black and blue. It begins on an autumn afternoon in the city of San Francisco, the city where I was born and where much of this tale unfolds.
Imagine a gay boy born in the Lavender Bermuda Triangle, raised pre-gay liberation, coming out just before the Great Awakening, and being a rather prettily handsome young man when that ish hit the fan, carousing to beat the band like any damn skanky hoe all through the 60s and 70s, blasted into stunned silence by grief and grisly death as the century ground to its horrific halt, and still alive now to tell the tale.
I guess I have a responsibility to do just that, since so many others didn't make it to this shore. So my tale, as I was saying, begins on an autumn afternoon in the year 1964, on my first day of college. My mother, much to my humiliation, had insisted on not only driving me to school on this first day of my adult life, but on picking out my wardrobe. A polyester horror of ankle-length pants, ankle-high mucklucks, imitation Pendleton shirt buttoned up tight, the whole fashion blunder topped off with thick-rimmed glasses and slicked-down hair. The campus was unfortunately only 10 minutes away from my parents' house where I still lived. If I'd had any sense at all, I would have gone away to college, ideally to the other end of the continent. But through a combination of apathy and fear, I opted for the easy way out. So there I sat in the passenger seat of her little red Volkswagen, hunched over and sullen, with that perfectly hideous outfit on, feeling like a trapped rat and looking like a drowned one. I had to plead with her to please, please drop me a few blocks from school to maintain what little dignity I had left, and she rather peevishly pulled over to the curb and asked me when I'd like to be picked up. I mumbled something about calling her later and slammed the car door as hard as I could in the poor woman's face. I could feel her outraged and disapproving stare burning into my back as I skulked away, cursing under my breath, "Oh, fuck you, you bitch," while silently screaming a la Susan Hayward, "I want to live!" I didn't want to be Norman Bates in Psycho. I wanted to be Sal Mineo in Rebel Without a Cause, but without that nervy Natalie Wood getting in the way. So off I stomped, looking, as they'd say today, hella weird, and entered the main theater of the drama department for a day-long, welcoming session. Picture it now. The theater full of young kids, fresh out of the box, drama queens no less, our brains dizzy with showbiz lyrics, bodies befuddled with hormone rushes, and our souls bursting with the mad desire to express ourselves. We were ready for our close-up, Mr. DeMille. We wanted inspiration, anguish, terrible, glamorous torment, fabulous costumes, an Oscar, and a standing ovation. But instead, on what should have been the precipice of a thrilling adventure, we were being lulled into lethargy by a parade of pompous professors, spewing banalities, until we were all squirming in a stupefying dither of disappointment and dismay. You could feel the air getting heavier and thicker with boredom as one by one heads began nodding. And even the occasional snore could be heard beneath the gaseous drone emanating from the stage. I started surreptitiously checking around to see if there was anyone I might be able to somehow browbeat into throwing me onto the stage floor right there in front of the student body, God, and Professor Osgood, tearing my goddamn geeky polyester pants right off my skinny ass and laughing the hell out of me. Like the boy in the seat next to me, for instance. The love child of Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte. Then suddenly I was roused from my reverie. When the air subtly but distinctly altered, as if the room itself gasped and held its breath, Professor Joseph Demillon had taken the stage, and I was instantly alert, attentive, and face to face with my destiny. He had Rasputin eyes, a hypnotic velvety voice, and the face of a Saturday afternoon second feature hero, a slightly noirish mix of Joseph Cotten, Gary Cooper, and Veronica Lake. He chain-smoked, ground his teeth, and expounded like an uncorked genie. He was brilliant. He was blonde. He was built. Bingo!
Was Donald Curry from his CD Sex and Mayhem, a wonderfully produced audiobook about growing up gay, coming out, and looking for love in 1960s San Francisco. It's available at www.cdbaby.com/Donald Curry. That's cdbaby.com/Donald Curie. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, John Beaupre, Graham Underhill, Jason Lynn, Chris Ambage, Brian Nunes, Rex Walkner, Brian Goble, and Donald Curry contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's an easy link to the show from our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners around the world. To learn how you can help in This Way Out's critical struggle to stay on the air, please visit our website at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KUOI Moscow, Idaho, CHSR Fredericton, New Brunswick, WTIP Grand Marais, Minnesota, and more than 125 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Everybody's going to stay tuned.